My name is Betty. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 18th, 1983. And this is my home group. When I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was on the Texas-Louisiana border. And they hadn't heard anything new since 1935, you know. And they had their own little AA house, and they had all the stuff on the wall, you know. And I was really bored with them, but so I read a lot of what was on the wall. And when I read the steps, what I knew was that I would never be able to do 8 and 9. Maybe I could make a list, but at the time my list wouldn't have been complete. But to make amends for the wreckage of my past was something I really didn't want to do. I wanted to be sober. I wanted to have a good life. I didn't think I was going to have it with those folks in the room. They were, it's a real rural area, you know, and they all looked like farmers, whatever farmers look like. And I thought I was deprived having to sober up in that little town of 3,000 people. And it turned out that I think that was probably the only place I could have really sobered up. I had to go to a meeting every day. I was sobering up with my husband. His licensing association was telling him how to sober up, and I had to do it with him. I went to that meeting every day, even on days they didn't have a meeting. They piled into a van and took you to some god-awful place in Texas or in Louisiana, and you went to a meeting. I sat there for 3 months. The only thing that kept me in that room was that my husband didn't take a drink, because I would have drank with him in that first 3 months. And I didn't want to be the first of us to take a drink, but if he had, I would have. But I kept listening to these people. And at first I didn't believe them, because I didn't believe a person could change. I had never seen anybody change. But because this town was so small, I got to watch them live their lives. I got to watch them do exactly what they said they were doing. And it was an amazing thing to me. I didn't know people could live like that. They were not impressed by me. They didn't care what I had. I thought I was better looking than them. I was smarter and I had more stuff. The only problem was they were happy and I wasn't. So at the end of 9 months, I mean 3 months, I decided that all of those things that I thought were true, but in this one instance, in knowing how to be sober and knowing how to live, they knew how to do it and I didn't. And so I thought in this one thing, I would listen to them and I would do what they told me to do. They assigned a sponsor to me because none of the other women wanted to have anything to do with me. I was mean. And this woman had about a sixth grade education. And I said to her, you know, I said, there are a couple of those things that I really am not going to be able to do. I'm not going to be able to become willing to make amends to the people in my life. And I am never going to make amends to my sister. And she said, you know what? She said, every time you open your mouth, you prove how alcoholic you are. And I wondered what it was in what I said that gave her a clue. She said, only alcoholics look at what they can't do instead of what they can do. You're not at 8. You're not at 9. You're at 1. And I said, oh, I've done 1. She said, I'm powerless over alcohol. And she said, and your life is unmanageable. And I said, no, my life is not unmanageable. I'm cooking dinner now, you know, and I'm driving. And she explained unmanageability as it applied to her, that she was sober for 10 years and her life was still unmanageable by her. And I thought, what's the point? what's the point staying sober if you can't manage your own life? You know, because I didn't have a power greater than myself, and that's why I was in such deep trouble. And I said to her, I'm not sure I believe in anything. And she said, oh, there's a 50-50 chance that there's something here other than you. And she said, nobody has proved there is, but nobody's proved there ain't. She said, why don't you take the 50% that will do you some good? And she said something that I tell all the women that I sponsor, and that is, when you decide that you want to believe in something other than yourself, you'll begin to believe in something other than yourself. And the big book talks to me about that. It says that if I just stop saying no, if I just stop saying never, that's the beginning. And that was the beginning for me. I took the steps with this woman. You know, I was overeducated. She was undereducated. But it didn't matter because she knew how to be sober. Her life was good. I said to her, I think that just living a better life, just being a better person, is enough amends. She said, it says direct amends. Direct means you sit across from those people and you make amends. And it's not just about an apology. When you get there, you have to tell them what you've done and ask them how you can make it right for them. Well, it took me about 8 months to do that. And when I made that list, I wasn't nearly willing to make amends to those people, but she told me to bring the list to her so that she could prioritize it. Because I have a tendency to want to look good, and so I would put those people at the top of the list that I want to know that I'm doing well. And she scratched off some of those people. I had a guy that I had a sick relationship with a long time, and she said, this man, will cross him off. You don't make amends to him this way. So, well, how will I make amends? She said, by never darkening his doorstep again. You know? This man has had enough. You know? And that was a good thing, you know, because my motives were not good. So I had my children, my ex-husbands, my sisters. I have three sisters and a brother. I had fired my brother as my brother. Something he did, like talk to one of my ex-husbands. But it was the fourth step that allowed me to get to the eighth step. That was the hardest step for me, to make an inventory of my resentments, my fears, and my sex history. And what I found in that was that I was so self-absorbed, so self-centered, that I never considered anybody else, not one person. And that was a bitter pill for me to swallow. I thought I was just wonderful and that I was brilliant and nobody understood me, and that had been my problem all of my life. And I realized that I never considered another person, even my children. You know, I think that I did all of the things that a good parent is supposed to do, but I didn't do it with my heart and my soul. I didn't do it because that was what mothers do. I did it because I didn't want people to think I was a bad mother. And I had to look at the motives for some of those resentments. But it opened the world to me, the fourth step. And without that, I could never have gone to my sisters. My mother died 3 months before I sobered up, and I couldn't show up for her in the hospital. I couldn't show up to her funeral. And I owed a lot of amends to all of my family for that. And there was no way I thought I could make amends to my mother for what I had done. And this sponsor was really... She may have been uneducated, but she was very, very wise. And she said, you'll find a way. God will put a way in your life for you to get some peace with this. And what happened was that several years later, when my husband's mother became ill, I was the only person who had the time and the free travel and everything that I needed to be able to go to Wisconsin and take care of her. So I took care of her for 3 years. And it took me 4 months to be able to get her into a nursing home. And I stayed in Wisconsin October, November, and December. That was the worst thing. It's worse than Salt Lake. It's worse than Montana. It's the worst. And I didn't recognize what I was being given. But I was complaining to someone I sponsored about how my sister-in-law, who only lived 17 minutes away, couldn't come and see her mother, couldn't take care of her mother, couldn't do this for her mother, blah, 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 blah. And it was Meg. And she said, in the middle of the conversation, that must be really hard for you, since that's exactly what you did to your mother. And I realized that it was exactly what I did to my mother. I let my siblings take all the responsibility because I could not show up. And that was where my sister-in-law was. So I got off the phone with Meg, and I went into the bedroom I was using, and I got on my knees and thanked God for giving me this opportunity to do for my husband's mother what I couldn't do for my own mother. And I had peace after that. My children wouldn't listen to my amends. They were embarrassed for me. You know, it's awful to have your mother sit in front of you and talk about that. And they would go, "Ma, it's okay, it's okay. But the sponsor said, that's not enough. That may be enough for them, but it's not enough for you. So you sit down and you write a letter to them. And with that letter, they can read it whenever they have the inkling. And later on in life, you can talk about it. When they're ready to talk about it, you can talk about it. But you write that letter and tell them what you think you did. In making those amends, sitting down with my sisters, and I realized that was the first real conversation I had had with those women in my life. The first time I looked at them and I thought about them. My youngest sister, I was her hero. And after I told her everything that I had done to her, she said to me, "None of those things bothered me. What bothered me was that I was never important to you." My sister is in her mid-60s now, and she's important to me, and she's been important to me for a long time. But that was only possible in the ninth step. My children, over the years, that's happened. You know, we've been able to sit and talk about that. My daughter told me something that broke my heart. For all the things that I thought I had done, what hurt her the most was that she wasn't important enough to me to make so that I would want to live for her. That never occurred to me. Ella told me that I needed to listen to what those people said. When I'm making amends, I need to listen, and I need to open up and give them the opportunity to say to me, "What about this? What about this?" And I was able to do that. I was able to do that because I took her direction. One of the things that I did was steal your drugs. If you were my friend, I went into your bathrooms, I opened your medicine chest. If you had a prescription in there, that I had a PDR, so I knew what was what. And if you had something that would modulate the way I felt, if it was over 6 months old, I'd take the whole thing, because you should have taken your medicine by then. Don't you think? If it was under 6 months, I only took half. And so when I went to those people and I tried to make amends for that, to a person, my friend said, "Oh, Betty, you should have told us. We would have given it to you." You know, without an inkling that we don't tell anybody about those things. And the eighth and ninth step made it possible for me to be able to live in the 10th step. This sponsor promised me that if I made a commitment to the 10th step, that I could change my behavior. And I did that. Not right away. It was really hard, but eventually I did. You know, if I have to sit down with you and say, I was wrong, this is what I did, what can I do to make this right for you? I am not going to do that too many times. You know, at one point, if I couldn't win an argument with my husband, I'd call him a name. I didn't use really bad things. It was like jerk or a-hole or something like that. And I had already made amends at least twice. And I was up in the loft of our house in Montana, and he was winning this argument that we were having. And I said, you person, because I wasn't willing to do that one more time. You know, I wasn't willing to sit down one more time. And I promise you that if you will make a commitment to the 10th step, it will change your behavior. Because I don't think you're so different than me. You know, there was a time when I thought you were totally different and that I was unique. But today I know that, you know, we pretty much have lived each other's lives. Thank you.
Thanks, Betty. Our next speaker is Bob D. from Las Vegas.
My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome the new people. This is, if you're new like I was new, step 8 and 9 made me, I wanted to bolt out of AA. I thought it was nice for you people. But I lived like an animal on the streets. I mean, every time I'd start thinking about the hundreds and hundreds of people I'd robbed and ripped off, the guys that went to prison because I dimed them out to save my own butt, the guy, my best friend that I'd knifed and he'd never be the same, my parents who'd done nothing but love me and I just gave them such an emotional battering over the years, over and over and over again till my mother took sedatives because of the anxiety and saw a therapist, and my father slept 16 hours a day. And I'd done that to them. They were able to finally cut me out of their life, but they couldn't cut me out of their heart. And I knew when I got sober, I'd done that. I knew how much I'd embarrassed a little sister that I was one time her hero, and she had to go to school, and current events and the kids at school would bring the newspaper articles about their brother's arrest for possession and sales of narcotics to class. And she'd have to come home from school in tears, being so embarrassed and ashamed. And I knew what I did. And I almost left because of it. But there's something behind the fabric of Alcoholics Anonymous that most of us come to know is God's grace. And God's grace works in a very synchronistic method. Synchronicity is a principle that was first coined by Carl Jung. And synchronicity is a view of the universe that presents it in such a way that if you need to go from point A to point B, and you can't, you just can't. The abyss between those two places is so overwhelming, you can't do it. You just can't. That from the moment of desire and commitment, the universe will start rearranging itself to make the impossible possible. And that really has been my experience over the years and with this amends. One of the great things that I got a sponsor when I was new, and I've had great sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had people that would listen to me but really didn't care very much about my opinion on what I thought I should do, and they just kept directing me to do certain things. Like when I was new in sobriety, they told me I had to make amends to my parents, and I said, you know, I know what you're saying. It's too late. It's too late. It won't work. They won't even take my calls. And this woman said, it was with the guy I'm talking to, she butted in and said, well, did you try not call and collect? Right. And I started calling. They told me to call my mother, not call collect. I remember the first time I did it. I was on the phone. My mom answered the phone. I said, "Mom, it's Rob."
Where are you? You're not in Las Vegas. Are you not in Pennsylvania?
I said, "No, I'm in Las Vegas." She said, "Well, the operator didn't get on and ask me to pay for the call." I said, "No, Mom, I paid for the call." Her voice jumped a whole octave. She went, you paid for the call? She couldn't believe it. Because in my narcissistic self-involvement, I had such a sense of entitlement, as if the world owed me. That's selfishness, self-centeredness. And I started calling my mother every week, and I tell you, she was like this. What do you want? And, you know, and I go to meetings and whine about how, you know, it's been sober 3 months and they still don't trust me. Well, let me tell you something. If 3 months sober, if my parents would have trusted me, there had been something wrong with their mental health, I'm telling you. When I was a year sober, my parents decided, after all these cards and letters and phone calls, they decided they were going to come out, fly out to Las Vegas and eyeball me. And here's what they did. They came out to Las Vegas. Here's their attitude. I remember the tone of voice. I remember everything. Their attitude is, well, you know, we're going to probably go out there and he's probably still a bum running the game on us. But, you know, we've never been to Las Vegas. It wouldn't be a total loss. And they flew out to Las Vegas, and I met him at the airport, and took him out to dinner with my sponsor and his wife, and I took him to my home group, and they got to see me with you, and I've never been better than when I'm with you. They couldn't have seen me in a better spot. They saw me with the old timers, and the old timers used to pick on us, you know, and then they watched me with the newcomers, and I'd pick on them because, you know, the first rule of plumbing, crap runs downhill. And I mean, you know, and they saw us joking around and all that stuff. And the day before they left, I sat down in a coffee shop with my mom and dad, and I'd owed my dad a lot of money. To me, making minimum wage in early sobriety, it was an astronomical amount of money. As a matter of fact, I figured it out. The game plan I was about to present my dad was 12 and a half years of payments. And I sat down with him, and I told him what I wanted to do. And I'll never forget this. He smiled and looked. My mom and dad smiled at each other, and he said to me, "Rob, we don't want you to pay the money. We're just so delighted that you're sober that we just want you to, we don't understand to say anything, but man, this is the first time we've had any hope you're going to be okay. I just want you to keep doing that AA. Forget about the money." Oh, I was elated. I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. I just hit the recovery lottery. You know what I'm saying, man? I mean, this is great. I walked out of there on cloud nine. I'm dashing over to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news. And on the way, I'm thinking about other people I owe money to. I wonder if I could get them to see the light like my parents did. I got over to my sponsor's office and I told him the good news. And he said, "It doesn't matter what your dad said. This is your debt. This is your integrity. You sold your self-respect a nickel and a dime at a time. You're going to have to find a way to pay it back." I tell you, if I ever wanted to change sponsors, it was right about then. And I said, "Well, what am I going to do? I can't send them this little check every month. They don't really need it. They're not going to cash it." He says, "I don't know, but I believe if you're willing." "And are you willing?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't know how, but I'd like to make this right." He says, "Then I believe God will show you a way." And I was working as a cashier in a store. Now, this is in the 70s. Working as a cashier, there was a lot of silver coins and silver certificates and gold certificates still in circulation. Every day they'd come through my register. And my father was had an obsessive hobby. He collected that stuff. And the intuitive thought came to me as, it was a funny kind of thought. I never imagined I could save up at face value what I owed my dad. But I thought, well, at least maybe if I talked to my boss, I could start buying this stuff out of the register every day and putting it aside. Maybe I could at least give him something. And I'll tell you, people who don't walk through this, never get that magical good luck that happens to those of us that start to make amends. And from the moment I started chipping away at this one and saving those coins and bills and paying off some of the other stuff I owed, it seemed like I started getting lucky. I guess in the realm of the spirit, there's a lot of cause and effect here. And all of a sudden, I started getting raises and bonuses. And a guy used to give me $100 cash for helping him move stuff. He had a little moving business. And what would have taken 12 and a half years, I saved up at face value bags of coins and bills equal to the amount of money I owed my dad. And I knew that I was going to give it to him, and he wouldn't give it back. It'd be like a crack addict giving back an 8-ball. I couldn't have done it. He just couldn't. He would have had to take it. And I gave my father that stuff. And I'll tell you something. Now I was four years sober when I gave that. I was four and a half years sober when I gave that stuff to my father. Oddly enough, my dad died when I was a little over 5 years sober. And by the time I gave that to my father, there was no doubt in my mind my dad loved me and forgave me. But I'll tell you something. When I made that amends, something changed. And for the first time in my dad's life, he started to respect me. And he loved me, but I think I was always Bob. You know, Bob. Bob, who never takes the responsibility for anything, Bob. The not quite, I wish he was, but isn't quite a stand-up guy, Bob. But when I made that amends to my father, he started to respect me. And it changed the whole dynamic of our relationship. And when my dad died the next year, he died, I'll tell you something, we were even. And I know what it's like to have people you love that you're hurt die and you're not even. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to make amends to those people by going to their, writing them letters, because the book says some people can't be seen, so we write them an honest letter. And maybe going to the years later, going to the grave sites. But my dad and I were good. And his spirit is within me, and it's a joyous thing. I talk to my dad occasionally. It sounds silly, but I'll tell you I do. When my daughter was born, I felt his spirit in that delivery room. When I sold my business a few years ago and I got the first of several seven-figure checks, I could feel him somewhere saying, "Way to go." I could feel his presence there. One of the hardest amends I had to make... the two hardest ones, one was I had to turn myself in when I first got sober and offer to go back to Pennsylvania and do the 2 years that was hanging over my head. That was one of the most frightening things I ever did. And I did it because a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't even at step 8 and 9 yet, but a guy in AA convinced me that I wouldn't stay sober on the run. And he asked me, he says, "You want to die of alcoholism?" And I said, "No." He said, "You have to do this, kid. You'll never stay sober if you don't." And I did it, and I was okay. And it was a big turning point for me. And the next hardest one I ever had to make was for something I did sober. When I was a year, you know, when you make amends for stuff you did when you were drinking, you can kind of hang it on the fact, well, I was screwed up. But what do you hang it on when you were a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And you did it. And when I was about a year sober, I started stealing from my boss. And it started out so innocently. I used to smoke cigarettes. My first couple years of sobriety, I smoked. And I had a strong habit, several packs a day. And I was living paycheck to paycheck, kind of trying to make amends and just get by. And one Thursday, I ran out of cigarettes, and I got a bad cigarette addiction. I'm at work, and I don't have any money till the next day, Friday. And one of the things we sold was cigarettes. So I talked to myself about it, which is the way I usually do it. And I thought to myself, well, we I'll take a pack of cigarettes, and then tomorrow when I get my paycheck, I'll cash the check like I usually do out of the register, and I'll ring it up. Seemed like a reasonable thing. Well, I had no idea of the powers of the alcoholic ego to rationalize, justify, and minimize. And tomorrow came, and I cashed my paycheck, and the fleeting thought went through my mind, you need to ring those cigarettes up. And immediately, my ego kicked in and said, you know, you work harder than everybody else here. You come early, you stay late. I mean, it's only a pack of cigarettes, for God's sakes. Everybody does this kind of thing. It's probably factored into the cost of operation. And I never rang those cigarettes up, and from that moment on, I started supporting a three-pack-a-day habit and never bought another pack of cigarettes. And I started stealing six packs of Diet Coke, and I started getting sicker and sicker. And I don't connect the dots, because in the realm of the spirit, often you do something over here, you don't get sick over there initially. Maybe you start getting sick over here and over here. And I started getting sick in AA first. I'd go to meetings, I couldn't listen to people. Everybody seemed like a phony hypocrite in AA. Now, I don't know, I'm projecting my own feelings about myself on the people in AA. But they all seemed phony. They all seemed full of crap to me. I was dating a gal at the time, started to pick her apart. Then eventually came back to my job. I worked for a good guy. Never mistreated me, but I started picking him apart. And one night, I got down on my knees to thank God for that day of sobriety like I'd been trained to do in AA. And I was on my knees in this little apartment off of East Sahara. I yelled out, God, what the hell's going on here? And the minute I asked the question, I knew the answer. I knew the reason I was getting sick and I was on my way out was because I'd been stealing from my boss and professing to be such an upright, honest member of AA. And with that knowledge came these feelings of self-loathing and shame. And I started to see myself the way I was, and it was not a pretty thing. And I realized what I must do, and I knew I needed to go to my boss and fess up and tell him that I'd been stealing, and it terrified me for a couple reasons. One is he had zero tolerance with that kind of stuff. I watched him scream and yell and physically throw a guy out of the store one day because he caught him stealing a guy that worked there. And I knew I was going to have to face that. And I don't have the money to pay him back. And I'm going to lose my job. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to go somewhere else and get another job. It's another blank spot in my resume. And I had a lot of those already, man, I'm telling you. And I don't know what I'm going to do. And I think the worst thing of all is that my boss, the guy I got to go face, has heard me prattle on at great length about my rigorous program of honesty in AA. And I just can't stand me. And I went to him and I started telling him what was going on. And he started yelling at me, man. Oh, man, I wanted to crawl under a rock. And he was done yelling at me and he didn't fire me. Blew my mind. And I told him, I said, I will pay every single dime of that back, I promise you. And I will never take another pack of cigarettes. And I never did. And not only did I pay back every single dime that I had stolen from him, I added on another 10% and another $50. And you know why? Because I know how I am. If I'm going to misjudge the amount, it ain't going to be misjudged in his favor. You know what I'm saying? So I added on another 10%. Because I tell you what, I wanted to get, even if it's an overkill, I want to get free of this. And I'll tell you a couple funny things that happened, and I'll close it. Within 30 days... And I didn't connect these dots for some time. Within 30 days of making that last payment, a guy came to me. Now, I was not looking for another job. I was happy there now. He came to me out of nowhere and offered me another job with a chance to make twice as much money and a chance for management and bonuses and all kinds of stuff. And I said, okay. And I went and talked to my boss, gave him notice. He was kind of happy that I got a break. He wasn't in a position at that time to pay me that kind of money. And he said, good luck, kid. And I went to work for this other guy, never stole a nickel from him, never took home a ballpoint pen. And I gave him $1.25 for his dollar every day. And in no time at all, through the help of a guy named Chuck C., I learned how to start going to work and helping God's kids and forgetting about myself a little bit, little bit. And consequently, as a result of that, I was running that joint in no time at all, which also made for an incredible increase in wages and salary and bonuses, which helped me to chip away at other amends. And it was incredible. I'm in a restaurant one night, and I ran into the guy that I worked for and stole from. He's in there with his wife having dinner, the guy I made amends to. I went up to him. I said, "Hey, how you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm doing all right." He says, "Actually, I'm a little down." He said, "I tried to sell my store, and because it's got a liquor license with it and a gaming license, I sold it to a guy who couldn't pass the gaming control board muster. And after these last 6 months, I got it back in my lap." And he says, "I'm a little discouraged because I thought I was going to be able to retire. I'm a little burnt out." He says, "But I guess it's not in the cards, and I'm back running it again, back owning the business again." And I don't know. I had an out-of-body experience. Do you ever find yourself saying something to someone, and then you just can't believe you said it? And I found myself saying to this guy, "Boy, I'd really like to buy. God, I'd love to buy your store." And the minute I said it, I was ashamed I said it. I said, but I don't have any money. I don't know why I said that. And he looked at me, and he says, "What's your day off?" And I told him. He says, "Meet me for lunch here." And I met him for lunch that day, and he had these papers, and we sat down, and he made me an proposition. He said, "If you come back to work for me, and if you can get the numbers up," he said, "that guy's run it into the ground. It's not doing very good. But if you can get the numbers up," he said, "I'll let you earn yourself into this business." And he gave me a plan, projection plan. He says, "End of 5 years," he said, "I'm out of here. It's yours." And now I'm a guy with no education. I'm a guy with a resume that has a lot of blank spots, a lot of dishwashing, a lot of telemarketing and selling blood occasionally. I mean, I don't got a good resume, you know. And I said, "You bet." And I went to work for him, and I started to build that business up. When I took it over, it was about $600,000. And I went to work doing what you told me. You said, "Just forget about the money. Go to help God's kids. Go to be of service. Forget about you. Just show up to be of service every day." And I started doing that, and within no time at all, a business that was doing about $600,000 a year, at one point we were doing just about $10 million. And I started buying properties around Las Vegas, and I retired out of that business, sold that company. It was 5 or 6 years ago now, I guess. And I retired very well. And it all came from an amends. I sponsor a lot of guys that come to me because they come to me for the wrong reasons. They don't come to me, unfortunately, for my recovery. They see the $200,000 Mercedes and the nice jewelry and the big house, and they think that, and they're 15, 20 years sober, and their life's a financial disaster area, and they think I'm going to teach them some kind of magic juju, you know, how to fix their life financially. In absolutely every case, it always comes back to unmade financial amends that have put them unconsciously in a position where they keep shooting themselves in the foot financially over and over again. And the guys that are willing to do it, and it's hard because the great cry of every alcoholic I've ever worked with is, yeah, I understand, but what about me? What about my finances? What about me? Like I get new guys all the time that goes, "Well, it says except when to do so would injure them or others. Aren't I an other?" I mean, no, other than you. Right? But the guys that do it, it's like it changes your karma. You know what? I didn't know what karma meant until I was listening to an Alan Watts seminar on PBS, and Alan Watts said something very interesting. He said that the word karma would literally translate out of the Hindu and the English into the word doing. In other words, I have all this bad luck. It's not the universe. I'm doing this to myself because I don't feel like I'm a worthy receiver of anything good because I'm not even. See, that's the problem. I could never fool the thing it talks about on page 55, the great reality deep down within me. And I always somewhere knew what I was. And my dear mentor and friend who died not too long ago, Clint Hodges, used to say something I really believe. He said, there's a world of difference between making all your amends and all your amends except one. And I just, not too long ago, just made one that I hadn't made. And I have a few I haven't made, but the only reason I haven't made them is I can't find the people. I got a guy stabbed I've never been able to find, and I've hired detectives. And I must trust that if I am supposed to make a direct amends to that guy, that God will cause him, will create the wherever. It's not my, but it's my business to keep my eyes and ears open. And every once in a while I'll look, I'll do a little internet search, and not there, okay, I move on. But it's my job to keep my eyes and ears open and try. And you know something? I can tell you with absolute honesty that there is no amends in my life that I either haven't made or I'm not willing to. The ones I haven't made, I'm telling you, I'm willing. If I were to find out tomorrow where Chris is, the guy I knifed, I'm telling you, I'd be on a plane to wherever he is within a week. I'm willing and I'm ready. I just don't have the wherever. And that's, God provides me with the willingness. He provides me with the wherever. I made the list. I made it when I did my inventory. And it's my job to make the direct amends when God makes it possible. Thanks.